Last week we learned that when Festus succeeded Felix as governor of Judea, he wasted no time in getting to know some of the Jewish religious leaders within his territory. And they asked a favor of Festus, that he send the prisoner Paul to them in Jerusalem. Now, presumably, they requested the authority of trying Paul themselves. But secretly, we know that they planned to ambush and kill Paul on his way to Jerusalem. Well, Festus did not grant their request. Instead, he invited them to return with him to Caesarea to lay out their case against Paul. When they did so, they were unable to prove any of their complaints against him. And the apostle proclaimed his innocence, saying, "Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I offended in anything at all." Now, if justice were uppermost in the mind of Festus, he should have acquitted and released Paul at that point. But he wanted to ingratiate himself to the Jews, so he has asked Paul whether he would be willing to travel to Jerusalem to stand trial under Festus's oversight there. But Paul again proclaimed his innocence and appealed to Caesar. And after conferring with others, Festus said to Paul, "You have appealed to Caesar? To Caesar you shall go." Now this would move the jurisdiction of Paul's case to the imperial court in Rome. But Festus didn't send him there immediately. An official visit by a local ruler gave him the opportunity to get input from one more versed in Jewish law than he. That visitor was King Agrippa. And the passage before us consists of Festus talking about Paul before Agrippa in two contexts, which will structure our message. First of all, Festus's private conversation with Agrippa in verses 13 through 22, and then Festus's public address before Agrippa in verses 23 through 27. And all of this is going to set the stage for Paul's defense before Agrippa in the next chapter. This is very much a transitional passage, but we do want to consider it. First of all, Festus's private conversation with Agrippa. Verse 13, "And after some days, King Agrippa and Bernice came to Caesarea to greet Festus." Now this King Agrippa was Herod Agrippa II. He was the son of Herod Agrippa I. And that is the Herod that we read about in Acts 12, who received the acclamation of the people who proclaimed him a deity, and divine judgment against him was swift. Acts 12:23. "Then immediately an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give glory to God, and he was eaten by worms and died." It's like every junior high school boy is one of their favorite passages, you know, eaten by worms. Well, such had been the ignominious death of the father of Herod Agrippa II, who visited Festus. This Herod was also the grandson of Herod the Great, about whom we read in connection with Jesus' birth. So he's a man of regional royal lineage. And he was friends with the Emperor Claudius, who had granted him rule of a small kingdom in northern Palestine. Now, accompanying Herod Agrippa on this official visit is his sister Bernice, who was living with her brother, some report incestuously, between her marriages. What was probably most important from the perspective of Festus is that Agrippa is Jewish. And thus, he's well-versed in matters of Jewish law. And his input would be very helpful to Festus, who has to write up a report of charges when he sends Paul on to Rome. So verses 14 and 15. "When they had been there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, 'There is a certain man left a prisoner by Felix, about whom the chief priest and the elders of the Jews informed me when I was in Jerusalem, asking for a judgment against him.'" Now, as we've come to expect from Roman officials, Festus relays the story of Paul in a way that paints himself in a most favorable light. He introduces Paul as a certain man left a prisoner by Felix. And there's likely a suggestion here that Festus only has to deal with Paul because his predecessor Felix has negligently failed to do so. Now, interestingly, Felix, his predecessor, was Agrippa's brother-in-law. There's not going to be a quiz, but because Felix was the husband of Drusilla, who was the sister of both Agrippa and Bernice. Okay? Agrippa, Bernice, Drusilla, Sibs, and then Felix is married to Drusilla, which makes him the brother-in-law of both Agrippa and Bernice. Okay. I had to really think that out when I was reading it. Well, Festus explained, and maybe, perhaps, you know, reporting on your brother-in-law might earn you favor. It just depends on that relationship. We don't know what the relationship was between the in-laws there. But Festus explains that some of the Jewish religious leaders informed him of Paul when he first visited Jerusalem, asking for a judgment against him. And he continues, verse 16, "To them I answered, it is not the custom of the Romans to deliver any man to destruction before the accused meets the accusers face to face, and has opportunity to answer for himself concerning the charge against him. Therefore, when they had come together, without any delay, the next day I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought in." And here Festus portrays himself as a swift administrator of Roman justice. He defends Roman judicial practice, the custom of the Romans, and he acts without any delay the next day to bring Paul before the judgment seat. Now, Festus conveniently fails to mention his desire to appease the wishes of the Jewish leadership, that desire that had actually been subversive to justice, keeping Paul imprisoned when he should have been set free. That would tarnish the image he's presenting of himself. There's always a selective reporting from one Roman official to another. Well, Festus then proceeds to summarize what had happened in his court, verses 18 and 19. "When the accusers stood up, they brought no accusation against him of such things as I supposed, but had some questions against him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who had died, whom Paul affirmed to be alive." So Festus explains that these Jewish accusers didn't bring the kind of charges against Paul that he was expecting. Probably that means there were no accusations that he had broken Roman law. I mean, that's why you end up in a Roman court, because you've broken law. That's what they're concerned about at all. Instead, he says the accusers had some questions against him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who had died, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. So their concerns about Paul were really religious. They were not civil. But note that they center upon Jesus, and specifically upon his resurrection from the dead, which was something that Paul affirmed. And we know that Paul regularly declared the truth of resurrection. We saw this before the Sanhedrin in Acts 23:6, when he said, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged." So Paul was preaching the resurrection of Christ as the first fruits of those who would be raised after him. And that was central to his message, and we know that it was something that divided the Sanhedrin. He brought the matter of resurrection again before Felix in Acts 24, verses 15 through 21, and now before Festus. And I want to say that Paul exemplifies the courageous proclamation of the gospel at risk to himself that we heard Jesus speak about in our message this morning on Mark 13. It is for Jesus' name's sake that he has ended up imprisoned, first in Jerusalem and now in Caesarea. And frankly, Festus doesn't know what to make of all this. Verses 20 and 21. "And because I am uncertain of such questions, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there be judged concerning these matters. But Paul appealed to be reserved for the decision of Augustus. I commanded him to be kept till I could send him to Caesar." And here again, Festus is being less than perfectly forthright in describing his decisions. It wasn't so much his ignorance of Jewish religious matters as his fear of the Jewish religious leaders that led him to ask Paul if he would be willing to undergo a trial in Jerusalem. Festus's pursuit of justice is tempered by his local political concerns. Now, he tells Agrippa of Paul's appeal to the emperor, to whom he will eventually be sent. That word Augustus, it's literally August One. It's one of the labels, one of the titles given to the emperor. So Augustus, August One, Caesar, they're all the same person. Well, verse 22, "Then Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself. Tomorrow, he said, you shall hear him." So Agrippa is intrigued by what he's heard. A Jew himself, he is familiar with Jewish religious matters. It's quite possible that he's heard about Jesus. He expresses a desire to hear Paul himself, and the ever-efficient Festus promises he shall hear him the very next day. Well, after this private conversation, the scene shifts to Festus' public address before Agrippa. Verse 23, "So the next day, when Agrippa and Bernice had come with great pomp and had entered the auditorium with the commanders and the prominent men of the city, at Festus' command, Paul was brought in." So Festus puts on quite a show for Agrippa, and you can imagine it took quite a bit of work to get this planned overnight, but he does. And we're told that the king and his sister come with great pomp, and that word pomp in the Greek is actually phantasia, and it sometimes refers to pageants and lavish ceremonial parades. So this was quite the show that was being put on for the visiting king and his sister. And it's not to be a private affair before just them. The guests include commanders and the prominent men of the city. Now, these commanders were Roman military tribunes, each of whom had charge of 1,000 troops. So these are very special, elite military officers. And the prominent men of the city were civilians of high rank and influential connections to the halls of power in the provincial government. And Agrippa was likely impressed by this gathering of the top people of Caesarea. And if you want to earn the favor of a guest like this, this is the kind of thing you do. You should throw him the best shindig you can. And that is what Festus does on very short notice. And then we're told that at Festus' command, Paul was brought in. And in the Greek, Paul's name is the very last word in the sentence. All of this has been leading up to the arrival of Paul, because ultimately the gathering is all about him. We continue in verses 24 through 27. "And Festus said, 'King Agrippa and all the men who are here present with us, you, plural, see this man about whom the whole assembly of the Jews petitioned me, both at Jerusalem and here, crying out that he was not fit to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing deserving of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I decided to send him. I have nothing certain to write to my Lord concerning him. Therefore, I have brought him out before you, plural, and especially before you, singular, King Agrippa, so that after the examination has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not to specify the charges against him.'" So Festus here addresses his guest with special attention on Agrippa. Now, one of the benefits of the old King James Version that many of us grew up with is that it distinguished in English between the second person singular and the second person plural. So in the King James Version, if you read thou, that's a singular. If you read you, it's a plural. It gets confused in ours because we've given up thou and we use you for both singular and plural, so we don't always know what it's referring to. And so I sort of emphasize that when I read the passage, because he's addressing sometimes all, but sometimes Agrippa alone. And he again summarizes where the case of Paul stands. The Jews had petitioned him, saying Paul deserved to die. Upon examination, Festus had not found Paul guilty of any capital crime. And when Paul appealed to the emperor, Festus agreed to grant his request. There was just one problem. Festus says, "I have nothing certain to write to my Lord," that would be the emperor, "concerning him," concerning Paul. So given the strange nature of the case, Festus doesn't know what charge to report as he sends his prisoner on to Rome. He says, "Therefore, I've brought him out before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the examination has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not to specify the charges against him." And once more, Festus is portraying himself as a dutiful Roman leader, only wanting to do that which is right and proper in matters of justice. I'm going to sneeze at some point here. And he honors Agrippa by suggesting that he will be able to provide the information lacking for Paul to be sent on to Rome. So as we said before, this sets the stage for Paul's defense, which we'll consider next time. Now, in terms of application, I think it's worthwhile to compare the motives of Festus and Paul. Festus is self-serving. He's willing to shade the truth. He's willing to tell a little white lie in order to present himself in the most favorable light. And by doing that, he's doing the kinds of things that would earn him advancement within the political structure. Festus is self-serving while Paul is Christ-serving. And Paul is willing to endure whatever suffering comes his way as he carries out his evangelistic mission. And everyone is confronted with a choice between these two ways of living. Will you live for yourself, or will you live for Jesus? All the way back in the garden, Adam and Eve chose to live for themselves rather than to live for God, and sin entered the human race and all of creation. Infected by sin, our natural disposition is to live for ourselves. It is what our sinful heart tells us and what the world around us advises us. The easy path is to pursue a life of self-serving like Festus did. The hard path is to pursue a life of Christ-serving like Paul did. That is the path Jesus called us to when he said we must deny ourselves, carry our crosses, and follow him. We must remember that Christianity is not simply a set of beliefs. It is a set of beliefs that form the core of a distinctive lifestyle. You know, it's very easy in our nation, in our day, to participate in church activities on Sunday and still lead a basically self-centered, self-serving life. But such a life casts doubt upon the Christian profession of the one who leads it. Jesus calls us to something harder, which is also something higher. While we cannot live such a life in our own strength, Jesus stands ready to live that life through us by the power of his Spirit. And so I think the call to us is to offer ourselves daily to his service, asking him to live and work through us in such a way that all the honor and the glory goes to him. And as we live that way, we have the joy of offering him our obedience and our worship. And so I would charge you to choose the way of Paul and not the way of Festus.